Successful people learn how to make their mind work for them. I'm David Nagel, and this is the Successful Mind Podcast. Marla Julian, thanks for doing this.
We are so stoked to be here.
So excited. Thanks, David, for having us.
I am unbelievably happy that you guys are here and we're willing to do this. This is really cool. And one of the things that really turns me on about this is that I work with couples all the time, helping them build their business. And relationships are such a major issue in the actual success that somebody's going to achieve. Because if they're not on the same value system, if they don't know how to communicate, about all the problems that we run into. And I wanted to know, like, give us your wisdom, because you guys work with such high-end people, celebrities, you know, high-end thought leaders, mm-hmm. high-end business owners. You see the challenges on a daily basis that people go through with relationships and then living their purpose at the same time. How do we overcome this? Like, how do we do it so that that our own success isn't at the cost of the relationship itself?
There's so much here. I mean, we could have a slumber party tonight. I'm just saying.
Yeah, seriously.
You know, one of the biggest things that we see is that if the behind the scenes, what's actually happening at home, is not in alignment with what the person or the people are putting out into the world for their work, that is what starts to destroy the business. It starts to undermine what's actually could be a really positive thing of what you're promoting in your business out into the world. If what's happening at home is...
And you mean relationship-wise.
In the relationship. Yes. And even behind the scenes in the business. So let's say, you know, we've worked with so many people over the years who their business practices are less than desirable. Let's just say that...
Skill set perspective or ethic?
From an ethics perspective. Meaning they say they want feedback from their employees and their contractors, but actually they don't really want feedback. They just want to continue to do whatever practices they want to do to bring in the money to, you know, have the business be sustainable. So there's a lot of clean out that needs to happen in most businesses, you know, to actually have a cohesive team who can express themselves at work and be heard. And if you're not practicing that behind the scenes in your relationship at home, it's highly unlikely that you're going to build a team that actually does that because you don't value it.
Yeah. Another piece that's really helpful is making pre-arranged agreements with each other, making agreements in advance of the troubles and the struggles and the challenges that are going to arise is as a couple deciding how we want to show up in that moment when those challenges and struggles arise.
Yeah, and you have to do that in advance because if you're in a conflict with your partner, you can't figure it out in that moment. You're just going to be in your default setting.
You're going to be activated. And right? When you're activated, it's oftentimes difficult to make clear decisions.
So am I right in my thinking about this, that from the perspective of how we're raised and like the future vision of your child, when you're raising your child, what they're going to go through in their life. This is not actually something that we're taught. Like, we're not taught in school. It's generally not discussed. It's a skill set that's very undeveloped in most relationships. Yes,
it really is. It really is. I mean, most of us, us included, you know, we just onboarded consciously and unconsciously whatever our families taught us. And then whatever the larger culture around us growing up was, you know, extended family, friends of our family.
Teachers, and, religious leaders.
And you just
All the authority figures. And because I know we love your teachings of, you know, before 7 years old, you really don't have a choice. There's no conscious choice before seven. You just onboard everything. So we take that on. And then if you never question it in your life, then you're literally bound to recreate the exact same patterns or the opposite patterns of your family because you're rebelling against the patterns. And so how do you choose something brand new? This is what we love about relationship work, is that when you have two people, now you have two brains instead of just your brain with your family dynamics and what you think the right thing is to do. Instead, now you have two people. And when you're dedicated to, we love to say, growth over comfort, when you're dedicated to that in your life together as a couple, then you know, oh, I'd rather grow as an individual in this relationship and as a couple than be comfortable. I'd rather have the truth in our relationship be completely the foundation. And as soon as I realize, oh, whoops, I'm out of integrity here because I'm not fully expressed in this relationship. As soon as I realize that, I bring it to Julian. As soon as he realizes it, he brings it to me. So it's a constant growth. And we love that over being comfortable, because if you're comfortable, obviously you're not growing.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that you just said was that like if you question it, right? So mm-hmm. prior to seven, we can't evaluate, we cannot compare and contrast. We grow up, this is the way that it is. We get in a relationship. Now you start to do something different. You're going to go after your dream. You grow, you mature, you find out you want more in your life. But then the problem arises, which then causes us to question it. What happens when we question it in a relationship, but it's like the foundational values or ethics, and we find out they're different with our partner?
It's pretty scary, actually. It's really scary, because what you're saying is exactly right. It's like, do we open Pandora's box together to really take a look at what's in there, like what you were raised with, what I was raised with, and potentially see the things that we don't agree with and then come to agreements together? Or do we just leave the lid on
right.
and not look at it? And this is what most couples do, is they really just choose to leave the lid on it.
Is there, so let's say this happens, because I do see this a lot, and what ends, you know, you end up with the combatant thing, like I need to protect my values, my partner needs to protect their values. That's the place that we go to. What can they do that is a safe practice for them as individuals and the relationship, so that they can address it? Can they bring another value in, like an alternate value that's consciously brought into the relationship, so that they can address these things in a safe space where they don't feel like they're personally threatened and they're not scared to death that they're going to lose the relationship?
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things that we love to do is encourage couples to actually get really silly with it first. So
silly,
like playful.
Humor.
Yes. Because it's like, if when you're looking at this stuff, it's really heavy and it can be really serious.
Yeah.
And people get really rooted into like, no, my way is the way, or, you know. And so we love to encourage couples to take a really out there silly kind of approach. So for example, it's like, okay, let's look at our belief systems around money, where we're not activated, we're not, you know, there's no stress around it in the moment. You're just, it's like a lovely Saturday afternoon, you're going out, go out to brunch together, and you're just finding out, like, what do I really believe about money? What do I believe about saving? What do I believe about spending? What do I believe about retirement? Just sort of asking some general questions and kind of write them down for yourself, and then your partner write them down, and then you can share them. And then the silly part is, what if both of our ways of believing in those things are actually not true? That there are other truths out there that we could get creative with how we want to choose to believe about this, rather than what we just naturally believe because of what we've been taught. And so some silly ideas are, what if it's best to spend everything you earn as soon as you earn it? Like, for some people, that's horrifying.
These are just playing with mental constructs. We're not actually saying to go out and do this.
Right.
This is just an intellectual.
Like a what if.
Yeah.
A what if.
Like,
yeah.
What if everyone on earth believed it was best to spend everything you earn, or to give away any cash you get, you're supposed to give it away immediately to the first person you see. You know, I mean, like, to really get silly with ideas that are creative and outside of any kind of construct that you would actually believe, so that then you could come back to, it's like swinging the pendulum, right? It's like, what I believe is on one end of the pendulum,
right,
and this crazy silly thing is on the other end. what do we actually want to choose to believe and to believe together? Because as you know, money is one of the biggest issues in relationship, and the conflicts around money are, you know, devastating for couples. And then when you're in business together, if you are not aligned with your value system around money, it, again, it will just undermine the success of the relationship.
And another great place to get a source of ideas for silliness is children. So if you have kids and you watch them and you see the way that they move through the world and the way that they interact with the world, you can get ideas on how to approach some of the more adult things by taking the concept that the kid is doing and then applying it to an adult situation.
Let me ask you a personal question. It's an individual, so I want answers from each of you on this. Was there a moment in time where you started to question your own beliefs based on the results that you were getting in your life, or did it happen over a period of time? Like a lot of different scenarios came up that caused you to question, like, why am I having these problems, or why is it this way? What do you think about that?
For me, it was definitely multiple situations where I would have an awareness, and then I would have to have the courage to look inside and face myself and then see what was really true and what was a lie. And then I would have that awareness and I would implement it. And then there'd be another awareness 6 months later, and I'd be like, oh, again and again, here we are. I now have to have the courage to then look inside again. And the truth is, the answers are all inside. And we just have to have the courage and the strength to be able to look inside and face that and then apply it to our lives and integrate it in. It's also really helpful to do when you have a partner who's also doing the same work. Mm-hmm. So as I'm doing my individual growth and Marla's doing her individual growth, and then we're doing the individual and then we're doing the growth collectively in collaboration in the union, which is the combination of Marla plus Julian, it makes doing that work so much easier because you have two sets of eyes looking and trying to be in support of the other. And so it just makes doing that hard work much easier when you have the support of a loving partner.
When you first started to do it, Julian, was it scary?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
What do you think the fear was at that time?
At the time, the fear was that I was doing something unknown. I was doing something against what my family was saying was how I was supposed to do it, or the right way to do it, what society was saying, what all the authority figures were saying. Well, you have to do it this way. This is the way we do it in this world. And I was going against that. And so I felt like a rebel. I felt like an outlier. I'm like, I don't know. Is this safe? And I know that safety is something that, you know, for adults is not really required in the intellectual sense. Safety for children, 100%, as you teach. And, you know, this is where I've gained a lot of my insights around this, was from being in your room. But the safety concept was like, oh, I don't feel safe. And that's a lie.
Right.
Because I am safe. So as soon as I'm able to step outside of that fear and realize that I'm totally safe, then I can actually begin to integrate some of those pieces.
Yeah. In the beginning, though, part of that idea about, because we're so inundated with the idea that you have to stay safe, don't risk too much, you know, know the outcome of everything before you do it, you know, for your whole life, the vulnerability that a person feels in that moment sometimes can make you feel like you're going crazy. Like, is this a crazy idea that I'm even thinking these thoughts?
Absolutely. If you feel crazy and then you go and you do the thing that was crazy and you're totally safe, and you're like, you literally restructure your brain. You restructure all of the frames that you thought were true. And you're like, but I just did the thing that I wasn't supposed to do, and it came out better than I even imagined. So what else am I telling myself I shouldn't be doing, or what other self-limiting beliefs am I imposing upon myself that if I break through them, there's magic on the other side?
Yeah. What was it for you, Marla?
You know, I think when I was still a high school math teacher, my constructs around money and the ideas around money for me, honestly, were like, I didn't really care about money. I never put any focus around money. I always had more than enough. I always had the ability to travel and do things. I never earned more than $62,000 in a year. And that was only at the high, high end in teaching. Yeah. And when I started to open to the idea that there was more for me in the world, I was completely lost. Like I knew that I had the capacity to earn a lot more money, but the way I was thinking about it was very incremental. It was very in the ways that society teaches, which is like, well, you could do this, or then, you know, you could get a job at the district office and earn six figures and maybe be a superintendent and, you know, those sort of incremental things. And I thought, that's not, I don't believe that, but I don't know what else to believe. And I think that that's where I had just a huge opening of, I don't know. I don't know how to do this. I know it's possible because I can see other people doing it. And my whole career before I was a teacher,
right.
You know, I was a body worker and I was a doula helping women through labor and delivery of their babies and postpartum. And I coached couples. And I coached couples on intimacy and, you know, after they had a baby. And I worked with celebrities and thought leaders way back in the day in my early 20s. And so I mean, I was at these million-dollar homes, multi-million-dollar homes for work every day.
That had to cause a question in your mind. Right?
I was like, how come they have this, but I don't? And so I knew what was possible, and I liked those homes. I really enjoyed those homes.
They're kind of nice.
Beautiful, and staff, and help, and support, and not doing everything yourself. But I had this idea that it's like, oh, that's for them, not for me. And it had to do with greed, and it had to do with ideas around, you know, don't want too much, and don't be too needy on society, and sort of ideas that didn't come from me as a person, as a human, as a soul. They came from ideas that I was surrounded with. Even if my parents and my family never said anything, those ideas were in their consciousness, so they were in my consciousness. And so when I first started to realize I want more, even though I loved teaching, I loved the kids, I loved the work I was doing, I knew I wanted more, and I didn't want to be at a job for X many hours a day at the same location. Like, there were certain things I'm like, this is not the life I want.
Well, wait a second. Let me interrupt for a minute. Yeah. What's your academic background?
I have a bachelor's degree, a BS in mathematics and neuroscience from UCLA, and then I got a master's degree in mathematics from Claremont Graduate University.
Okay, so did the academic value system come from your family? Is that where that came from?
Yes. I mean, it was assumed that I would go to college.
Yes.
But, you know, I was a pretty big rebel in my family. So I did actually go to college right out of high school. I went to Cal State Northridge, and I was a journalism major for the first year and a half. And then I dropped out and I went into the workforce, and I started working as a doula and a massage therapist and everything, a body
worker. Now, how does that happen? Like, those two roads aren't supposed to actually kind of come together in the way that we traditionally think. You have academic, but then you've got this human perspective where you're really connected with another individual. What drew you to that?
Into body work and all of that? Yeah, well, so I was completely turned off by university life. I thought it was structured in such a way that built more hierarchy, which on a fundamental level, I don't believe in. I believe we're all here for a purpose, and every human life has the same value. And it's just a matter of what we express through our gifts. And some gifts are meant to be, you know, staying at home and enjoying your family. And some gifts are meant to be like Oprah out on the big world stage and everything in between and beyond. And so on a fundamental level, I didn't believe in what the university was teaching, being in a classroom and this person teaching all this information. And then I have to regurgitate it and get a certain grade on a test in order to pass. And it just felt like that's not learning. Experiential learning is what I valued at the time. And so I wanted experiences that were going to help me grow. And so I realized at a certain point, this is not for me. And I went against my whole family structure to actually leave and say, I don't want to do this. And I'm going to leave without a degree. And actually, I'm so glad I did, because, you know, I went back to school when I was 30. And I went back and I had to start completely over because I thought I wanted to be a medical doctor. So, you know, I started completely over at community college and I had to build up and then I transferred to UCLA. So, and in a completely different realm. So journalism versus mathematics is right. completely different. None of my units transferred from Cal State Northridge.
There was a pretty big pivot for you though in life. What kind of the universe?
Oh, why I went back to school?
Yeah, the universe came down and.
Oh yeah, really I probably would not have gone back to school except actually I felt a lot of shame around not having a degree. I felt a lot of shame about not having a degree. Because in my family structure, it was like, if you don't have a degree, at least a bachelor's degree, then it's almost like there's something wrong with you. And
really?
Yes. And so I wanted to go back and just complete that. And yes, what Julian's talking about is I rolled my car down Topanga Canyon in Los Angeles and walked out of that without a scratch. But that's when I gave up my whole massage clientele and I went back to school and I started over.
So, but there were, what's interesting though, is that you followed this internal instinct for the human connection.
Yes.
To be a massage therapist, to be a doula, you have to really understand a person and emotion and what they're going through and the cause and effect of their body and to be present, emotionally present for people, you know, in that process. So it was kind of like there was this, the universe was kind of guiding you.
Yes. Into right? intimacy.
Into intimacy.
One of the most intimate times in a woman's life is when she's pregnant and giving birth and after the birth. Like, it's one of the most intimate times in a couple's life. But a woman who chooses to have a baby is, I mean, it's really like the whole miracle process of, wow, we can actually create life inside of us and then birth it out, and then they grow into one of us. Like, it's kind of amazing. And so, you know, and then I ended up specializing in twins because I like intensity. And so, you know, it's like, wow, the most intimate time in a couple's life when they are having to learn how to take care of a child or children at the very beginning stages, and you know this so deeply too, both of you, is you're literally responsible for another life. And we don't realize that we're literally passing on all of the material that we have not worked through on our own about our own family dynamics. And so this is one of the reasons why Julian and I are so dedicated to this work with couples, is because we love helping couples undo the patterns that they were gifted and make conscious choices about what they want to continue to give to their family lineage and also to their legacy out in the world.
So I think what's really interesting about this is that you followed this path and it led you to wanting to work with couples, both of you,
mm-hmm.
In a way where they get to work on, number one, their intimacy with themselves, which, like, I wasn't raised that way. I had no idea who I was internally. I didn't know who I was at all. Right? Let's just say what it is, right? Like, I had no idea. So how do you begin to work with somebody? Like, what brings you into the life of a person that is having this problem? How do they know when to call the intimacy experts into their life?
Often it's resentment. Resentment tends to be one of the big issues that naturally happens in relationship. If you're not actively dismantling the resentment on a regular basis, it tends to collect and then it gets overwhelming. And then that's when the separation begins. And so often couples will come to us where there's lots of resentment, and then we kind of help them piece apart what the truth is, because a lot of the resentment is based in a lot of lies and a lot of fabrications of thought. And we teach them true intimacy, and true intimacy is about trust. A lot of times people think that intimacy is about sex. Intimacy is about trust first and sex secondary, right? The sex will come, the physical intimacy will come once the level of trust has been established firmly within the relationship. And so we teach couples how to take the resentment and clean up the what we call sweeping the porch. And we sweep the porch in our own relationship every night. So there's no resentment that gets left over that can then accrue. And so we teach couples how to sweep the porch every night and use their intimate relationship and how to build it to remove the resentment that builds.
Those resentments, they can build up even very small, right? Like
yes.
little slights or... interpretations of something and making a story about why somebody did something or didn't do something and not communicating it. Is that right?
Absolutely correct. Absolutely.
And then they're stacking them.
Right. Well, it's like and they don't realize it. I mean, it's fascinating. I mean, even just in our own relationship, sometimes, I mean, even though we sweep the porch every night, and meaning it's like, is anything building? Do we need to talk about anything? What's going on? I usually am the one who stacks resentment. And the way I notice that is if I'm looking at Julian and I'm watching Julian and I'm judging him, if I realize, oh, I'm judging him for what he's doing or how he's doing it, or I'm somehow making him wrong in some way, that's me stacking resentment under the surface.
Well, that's interesting.
Right? And so when I realize that for myself, then I say to him, hey, babe, I think I'm stacking up some resentment. So can we clear that? And then we do like a venting session, which is actually kind of really a beautiful and easy technique. Happy to share that now real quick, which is the person that is feeling the resentment just speaks it out loud. And the person receiving the resentment doesn't look at the person talking at all.
But there's an agreement you're going to do this process.
Yes.
It's not just you do it and they don't know what's coming.
No, right?
This is one of the prearranged agreements that we set in advance.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's like, hey, can we clear resentment? I've got some resentment building and it's not just about you. It's about other things too. Yes, I'm happy to hold space for you to do that. Okay, great. So let's get a piece of paper and a pen out. Okay, good. So you hold the pen and paper and you're going to write down bullet point notes about what I say. Okay, and you're not going to take any of it on. You're going to do your best to not react to anything because this is just me sharing what's going on for me. If you take it on and make meaning out of it, now we have an issue to deal with. But if you could just let it like water off a duck's back kind of a thing, then I can just feel heard and expressed, and then we can deal with anything that actually we need to deal with. But don't make it worse by, you know, making some meaning out of whatever I say. And then I vent and I say, you know, I feel like I'm doing all the dishes, which is not true, but, you know, and I just list off the things that I feel resentment about. And it's kind of like,
give us some examples. Like the dishes thing, I think it's a good thing. Like,
yeah.
They don't have to be real to your life. But
he does more dishes than I do. So that's never resentment that comes up for me.
What are examples that people could be like, yes, I see that in my own life. I'm like,
yeah,
you left your underwear on the floor or your socks or the dishes or you didn't take the dog out. Like, what are the things?
So sometimes like cleaning up the living room. I care more about cleaning up the living room than Julian does.
Or if I leave my wet towel over the side of the door as opposed to putting it back on the rack.
He doesn't do that anymore because that was like a big, like, you know what I mean? On top of the door.
Okay.
Rather than on the hook. Yeah. Like, why is it there?
Right.
Okay. What's another one?
Blueberries.
Oh, that's an old one.
That's blueberries.
Blueberries. So I am very sound sensitive. So I'm very sensitive, period. But so auditorily, sometimes sounds can really like get under my skin. And so
there was one time where I was enjoying my blueberries.
Frozen blueberries.
Frozen blueberries. And I was sucking them in, just putting it on the and just kind of.
Okay. And we were laying in bed. Okay. And I look over at him and he looks like a happy little garden gnome. You know, he's like so happy and he's just like eating his blueberries and I am seething inside. I want to claw his eyes out. I'm just like, that sound, I want to kill you.
It's making you crazy.
It's making me crazy. And I'm, you know, we teach this stuff, right? So I'm like, I'm not going to harm him, obviously.
Right.
But what I'm going to do is I'm going to give him some options. Speaks for both of us. So I let him know, I'm like, hey, I totally don't want to steal any of your joy right now. And I'm like grinding my teeth off over here, trying to manage the noise of those blueberries. And so would you be willing to either stop eating the blueberries, go in the other room to eat the blueberries, or I can leave the room and you can enjoy the blueberries in the bed? And he said nothing. He just literally got up with a smile on his face and walked out.
With a little wave.
With a little wave. And then he came back like a few minutes later when the blueberries were done. And it was a real vulnerable. These are the little things that if we don't address them, like if I had said nothing, I would have started to resent his happiness. He's happy at my expense. This is the fucked up words that go in our mind that we start making meaning that's not true. But like he's allowed to be happy, but I'm not. And that reinforces an old pattern in my brain that's not true. So instead, I'm like, oh, it's so vulnerable for me to tell you that I'm hating on you right now. And I don't want to. So can we find a few solutions? I have found three. Maybe there's another solution I haven't thought of. And then it was my work to be okay with that sound and really do the work to calm myself and all of that.
And now you've even come full circle where you went and picked up some frozen blueberries and wanted to experiment.
I wanted to play and see, you know, it was like a kind of, in my family structure, this was never spoken out loud, but it's like you couldn't have two people happy at the same time. Only one person could be happy
in
at
your
a time
family.
In my family. And my family members might actually not agree with that. But in my experience, I was not allowed to be happy unless everybody else was already happy. But I couldn't be happy by myself. So it was like I had this sort of skewed version of happiness. And so I judged Julian for being joyous because I wasn't in joy, and I wanted to take him down to my level of not being happy in that moment. It's really vulnerable to share that.
And here's an example of learning from children, because you actually learned.
Oh yeah, with
Zoe.
Zoe. Yeah, yeah. Julian's 10-year-old daughter.
So I have a 10-year-old daughter, Zoe, that we get to co-parent, and you tell the story.
Yeah. So I had some weird idea that if she was unhappy, as children get, you know, right, from time to time, that it was unkind if I expressed happiness and joy. That it somehow it would make her, that it would make it seem to her like belittling her.
I think a lot of people have that problem.
Well, it was so weird. And so I asked her, I said, hey, I have this idea that when you're unhappy, that if I'm happy, it's going to hurt your feelings. Is that true? And she looked at me. She's amazing. She looked at me and she goes, not at all. Actually, it's helpful to me. If I'm unhappy, but I see you happy, I'll come out of it faster.
Because happiness is a higher frequency of a higher vibration. And it moves at a faster pace than the unhappiness. And so you will basically get into co-resonance with the joy. If you're an unhappy person and you are surrounded by happy people, you will naturally find that your level of joy, without doing anything, starts to lift and starts to rise because of the environment. You know, everybody knows you're the product of the five people that you spend the most time around.
Sure.
And so if you're around miserable people, then you're going to be miserable. And if you're a happy person, you want to be
Around other happy people. But, well, either, so if you're the unhappy person and everybody else around you is happy, you'll either raise your vibration to their level or you'll leave.
Oh, you'll
leave,
you right.
won't be able to maintain that level of low vibration. And this is why in relationship, if you're both dedicated to growth over being comfortable, then let's say I'm in a great place and Julian is being challenged for the moment, that I don't lower my vibration to meet his, he intentionally will raise his vibration to meet mine and vice versa, right? So like we're not allowed to dim our light in our relationship just because the other person is not doing great in the moment. Like that's an explicit agreement we have.
It is.
Yes.
That's interesting. Well, let me ask you this. Go back to the blueberries for a second. When Marla made that request, how did you feel in that moment?
Initially, I felt resistance to like, what the fuck? I'm just eating fucking blueberries. And I could feel her, though. I could feel her level of anxiety around it and her level of stress around it and her auditory. She was physically unpleasant. She wasn't enjoying being in her physical body at that moment because of the sound that I was making. And so I understood that. And for me, I didn't even respond. I just smiled and I waved and I removed myself. And then in the other room, I continued to enjoy my blueberries and and then did the internal work to downregulate the initial activation that had arisen because I was just laying in bed and eating blueberries, minding my own business, doing nothing. How am I in the wrong here? And I could then see it from multiple perspectives and see it from her perspective of like, she's trying to have a quiet night in the bed, and the thing that I'm doing is activating her in a way that she doesn't want to be activated. So for the benefit of all, how can this work out? And so the best way to do it was to exit the room, do the work, and then come back into the room and reconnect. And then talk about it and say, hey, you know, I didn't really enjoy that. How can we navigate this in the future? And she says, well, I didn't really enjoy the sound. So I said, okay, so I can eat the blueberries quietly. I don't have to do the auditory sound, even though it's pleasurable and fun.
Yeah.
It's not necessary. It's an extra. So I can still enjoy my blueberries and have my peace of mind, and she can still have the quiet in the bedroom and have her peace of mind, and we can create a win-win.
And then actually I worked on that because I want him to be able to be exactly who he is and not have to change himself for me. So my work was to learn how to soften and relax into whatever sounds are going on in the house. And it's not an issue anymore. Like, he can eat blueberries however he wants now. This brings up
receiving. Like, how are you receiving your partner? Like, so often in relationship, we don't receive the totality of what our partner is giving. And we don't...
Because we're judging it along the way.
And we're making meaning around it. Like, we think that we know, and we make assumptions, and we go, I know exactly what this is. And one of the things that we instruct couples to do is, if you don't know, ask. And if you know, also ask. Because we're constantly changing and shifting. So don't make an assumption that you know your partner.
Right. Leave room for growth. Like, if you think you know your partner and you think you know everything about, oh, well, he always does this or she always does that, you're literally putting a limit on who they are and who they can grow into. So anytime you're going to say, oh, yeah, she always does this, you just watch that and remove that from your vocabulary.
Yeah, that's a good red flag. If you hear yourself saying that,
you know,
that's a good
and
time.
I think that this issue is so common, and it brings up. It's like, so women in particular who are very ambitious and who care a lot about their business and who are crushing it out there in the world. And then we come home, and if we don't shift out of the ambition and into relationship, then we are in a danger of being in control of the relationship. And you don't want to be in control of the relationship. You want
to be in surrender to the relationship.
And you want to be the union between the two partners is really what's driving the relationship. So, one of the ideas that we have that we practice and teach is making deposits into the union of the relationship. So it's not like
what does that look like?
Yeah. Deposits. So for example, Julian, for the blueberry issue, this is such a good issue. You know, I made a deposit in the union by not just saying, can you just stop that? Because in the past, that's probably, I would have said that with that exact horrible tone. And then that would have started a fight, and that would have been really unpleasant for both of us. So I made a deposit in the union by not doing that and instead saying, taking responsibility, saying, hey, I'm really struggling with this. I've come up with three options. What can we do? Julian then made a deposit into the union by smiling and waving and leaving the room and taking care of himself in the way that he wanted to. So we both chose to make the deposit in the union for that, rather than saying, I'm doing this for Julian, or he's doing it for me. Because if he's doing it for me, then resentment can creep in, because you start to say, well, that's the tally, right? Oh, I did this, I did this, I did this, I did that. And what have you done? Right. So you start to, that's the resentment list.
Yeah. There's a lot of that. Like, I did this. Yeah. Like keeping track,
keeping tabs.
Yeah.
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 That's the danger.
What happens when you run into where a couple says, yeah, but he should know that making those sounds, I shouldn't have to say anything to him. He should know it. And I feel like I'm being disrespected because he knows it bothers me and he's doing it anyway.
Yeah, that's someone, it's very common, but honestly, that's someone who was raised with fantasy, meaning they bought into the fairy tale life of the princesses and they might not realize it, but these are people who basically believe that men and women should just know what they need and what they want.
But that's what love is.
That is not love. Love is not knowing what your partner needs. It's being, it's like what Julian just said. It's like, if you think you know, ask anyway. It doesn't take away the spontaneity. It doesn't take away the sexiness to ask. Because, first of all, every woman likes something just a little different. And how can you expect their partner to just know? I mean, it's like, ask yourself, if you're a woman and you like to receive flowers, okay, but your partner never really brings you flowers, have you ever told them? Have you ever said, hey, I just want to let you know, I love flowers and I would love to receive flowers, like maybe even once a month kind of a thing. Is that something that you would be willing to do? Right? If you've never said that explicitly, but you're secretly resenting your partner for never giving you flowers, that's not their fault. That is not their responsibility to just dig into your subconscious to know what you need. It's your responsibility to express your desires and what you want.
What do you say to somebody if they say, yeah, that's great, but it's not romantic?
Then it's time to redefine what romance is.
Because I have heard that before, where people say you have to ask your partner for what it is that you want. You have to tell them. And they'll be like, using the flower thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but he hears me say that I like these flowers and I like these flowers, and he never gets me the flowers. Like, what else do I have to say? If I have to tell him to do it, then
it
it's not
count,
really romantic.
Right?
It doesn't count.
Right.
Yeah.
They don't get it, let it count. Let it count. Let it all count.
But where do these ideas come from?
It comes from fantasy.
How the fuck do we get this concept in our mind that the other person, because we're in love, is supposed to know what the hell we're thinking?
I mean, let's deconstruct that.
Okay.
Where does that come from? It comes from media. It comes from all of the rom-coms and the
Walt Disney's movies.
Yes. All of the Disney movies of, you know, what men are supposed to do for women. And, you know, it's insanity to think that your partner should know exactly what you need. Also, if you're actually growing individually in your relationship, how can you expect them to continue to know what you need? They're not psychic. And even if they are psychic, it's very challenging for psychics, honestly, to know what they personally need and what the people that they love around them need. They can be psychic for other people, but very rarely for the people who they actually love and care about. So you need to ask.
And those couples who are making it wrong or in either direction are not giving each other the benefit of the doubt, which when you give your partner
right.
the benefit of the doubt, it's like, well, he wants to give me flowers, but he doesn't know. So he just wants to please me. So if I just give him the easy steps on how to please me, then we all get to win.
Oh, there's another piece to this, which is this is uncovering. There's a belief of withholding. So a partner who wants their partner to know what they need and want has a stronger belief in the idea that their partner wants to withhold from them and not that they can't have what they actually want in relationship, then they can. Because if you really believed that you can have what you want in relationship, then you wouldn't care if it came from their natural ability to know what you need or want, or from you being able to explicitly say, here's what I would love and want without the demand.
So you're telling me that the person assumes that the partner's consciously or intentionally, I should say, withholding from them.
Or unintentionally. It doesn't have to be intentionally.
Okay.
But
that's the assumption.
Yes. It reinforces an old belief that I'm never going to get what I really want and need. And so if you want to break through that old belief system, then the idea is that you are you go first. You know, in relationship, we often think, well, he should do it first. I do so much. He should go first. No, you go first. As soon as you have the knowing that you need or want something, it's your responsibility to bring it to your partner and say, and not, I mean, otherwise, what are the other options here? Wait until they get it. And if they haven't gotten it, right?
Right.
In years, what makes you think they're going to suddenly get it? They won't. So instead, how about you go first? Meaning you be the vulnerable one to say, wow, you know, it's really vulnerable for me to share with you that I kind of feel like I would really like to have flowers. And you've never really bought me flowers on any kind of consistent basis. And I'm a little embarrassed I even want that because I kind of want you to just know.
And give them the full, like the full file, like let them know what flowers you want, what color flowers, like don't say
how often you want them.
How often? Don't say you want flowers and then you get flowers and they're the wrong flowers.
Maybe a couple of your favorite flower shops also, you know, set them up for success.
Yeah.
And then you can even say, then you got to ask, because you can't just demand it. You need to ask, like, is this something that you'd be willing to do for me? And if they say yes, you can even say, do you need any support around it? Like, do you need to put a reminder in your phone? Or, you know, is there anything you can do to make sure that you set yourself up for success so that I get my needs met and it feels really good to both of us? Like, I don't want to feel like I'm bulldozing you. I want you to also get excited about wanting to do this.
So it's okay to make, it's okay to like, to determine individually within a relationship what romance means and is to each other. And then what our needs and desires are, and then make agreements to do that. Yes?
Yes. Yes.
So when I was a teenager, I went out on a date one time, and I did not have a lot of teaching around this from my mother and my father, but I had basic manners the way that they were taught, you know, in the late 60s and the 70s and the 80s. And one of them was you let a woman go first, you open a door for a woman, this type of thing. And like,
I'm talking about chivalry.
Chivalry, exactly. Yeah. So I go out on this date, and it's probably, I don't know, it's the first or second date that I am with this. Like, we're teenagers, right? So I think I was like 16, 17. And I open the car door for her. And she says to me, what the fuck are you doing? And I was like, I wanted to crawl inside myself. Like, I didn't know what I did wrong. And she said, I'm an independent woman. I can open my own fucking door. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to cry.
Yeah.
You know, I felt really bad. Like, I thought I was doing a good thing. Yeah. Like, I was trying to step into my masculinity and do a good thing. And I was shredded for it.
Yeah.
Right. And there was no consciousness about having the conversation. Like, it was a very long drive to dinner that night and not much was said about dinner. And then it was, you know, we dropped her off and there was like a little peck and then that was kind of it. Right. The relationship did continue for a while, but she very much had this, you need to know, be able to read my mind first. I had no skills, none. Right. So that actually became a wound for me for a while. I became very nervous, like if I went out on a date, until I got to know the person. I want to do something out of politeness and kindness and the way that I was taught of, like, chivalry, doing something for someone, but I didn't know if it was going to offend them or not, right?
Yeah.
So, like, is that a bad thing that men want to do those things because we were raised that feels good for us to do it?
Not at all. It is a very strange climate right now with,
agreed,
do you open doors, do you not? Some people get really offended by that. I don't. I love it. I also open doors for people too. Like, it doesn't have to be a one-way street.
Sure.
But that particular incident, and we are not taught this, right? This is one of the reasons why we're so, you know, into what we do. Is that incident could have been an opening of a deep, vulnerable conversation, which is, wow, it's amazing to me. I was raised that this is a kind, loving thing to do, and now you're literally educating me because you're telling me it offends you, and it's confusing to me, like, would you share with me more about what you actually like, about what your preferences are? Because I have an idea of what women are supposed to like, but obviously that's not true for you. So would you share with me more? And this is what we always encourage, which is ask more questions. Instead of making assumptions and make statements about people in your mind saying, oh, well, she's like this or he's like that. Instead, ask yourself, what can I ask this person who seems to be offended or who seems to be, you know, moved in a direction that was completely opposite to what I intended, how can I get curious? Curiosity is one of the greatest qualities that you can bring to any conversation. It's like, how can I get curious about what is true for you? Because I'm actually confused now. Now, it's so hard to do that. There's no way you can do that at 17 years old.
No, neither one of us were prepared to be vulnerable at 17. You know, and we hadn't worked through any of our family stuff at that point. So it was very reactionary all the way around. Yeah. Like, you know.
But people listening now, like, if you can use curiosity as your first go-to, like, your first reaction internally, you have no control over. It just arises. The chemicals start flowing. You know, you have the thoughts that arise first, and those come from your default settings, from your family lineage, and from what you've taught yourself and what you've been taught. And then you have your choice about what's going to come out of your mouth and what your body language is going to look like and what your intention is going to be. And so if your intention can be curiosity first, then you have spaciousness in between you and your ideas of what should happen and what is actually happening.
So this then spills over into the bedroom, does it not?
Oh, yes.
Absolutely.
Because there's this guy thing that, number one, we're not taught anything about sex, very, very little. No. But there's almost this expectation that we should know how to please our partner.
Absolutely.
Right?
And you're not a real man if you don't know how to.
Exactly.
And women are taught you are supposed to just receive whatever this partner is giving you instead of actually having a choice or a voice in guiding. You know, we're supposed to just receive whatever you give. And it's so bizarre. I mean, it's literally a system that sets us all up for failure.
And then we get mad at each other.
We get mad at each other like, oh, God, why doesn't he know that that's not like the spot?
Because we're making the meaning. We're making meaning about what this person's doing or not doing.
Yeah.
Instead of having the vulnerable conversation. It's the same thing. You know, it's like.
So how do you, like this guy thing. I want to just touch on this for a second, if that's okay. Because I hear this from men. I hear this problem. They start to go down this road where they're starting to try to communicate. But in the bedroom, it's way more sensitive. It's like now I'm on a heightened level of vulnerability, right? The woman starts to ask for what she wants and the guy feels inferior in that moment. Like, I'm not good enough.
Right. Right.
Yeah. I mean,
how do us guys deal with that, Julian?
Ooh, you have to have, a sense of self. You have to go inside. You can't be looking outside of yourself for the validation. So you go inside and you ask yourself what's true, and then you do your best to communicate what's true to your partner. It's having the courage to be vulnerable, to bring all of these things that you don't want to talk about, that you want to hide away in the closet and never discuss. And it's having the courage and the vulnerability to bring it to your partner and say, hey, I want to please you. And this is, I'm feeling like inferior in this moment because you're asking me to give you something and I feel like I'm supposed to know how to do it without you telling me. And so I'm going to bring this to you so that you and I can discuss this together and bring it out into the open. And just, I think the best way to do it is just to pull out your flashlight and shine it in all the dark corners of the things that you don't want.
That was a visual.
Yeah, that's a visual. Flashlight. That's a visual. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, I don't
We could go down a lot of roads there.
Yeah. And have the courage to with your partner, shine the flashlight in a dark corner of a place in the bedroom where you don't want to go at all, and have the courage to go there and do it with your partner in collaboration. And, you know, with your partner having the concept of the benefit of the doubt that we're going to get through this together, and then celebrating the mistakes. Like, it didn't go the way that we had wanted it to. It went a little bit different, and that's okay. We're not going to celebrate the mistake to repeat the mistake. We're going to celebrate the mistake to have awareness around the mistake and then to consciously make a different choice in the future.
So
you'd like to show up.
So let me just, like, feedback what I'm hearing you say. What I'm hearing you say is that the entity and the value of the relationship supersedes the individual insecurity. not in a way where it diminishes it, right? But it actually brings it to the surface where it's safe to do that because we both together value this relationship over our insecurities. And we want to address those things so that the relationship stays strong as we grow as individuals within the construct of the entity of that relationship.
Absolutely. It's kind of counterintuitive because you feel that like the vulnerability is like being weak. A lot, oftentimes men are taught that to be vulnerable or to be sensitive is weakness.
Oh, seriously? Yeah, totally.
It's
yeah.
totally counterintuitive because that sensitivity and that weak, that sensitivity and that vulnerability is actually what creates the strength in the relationship. It's like,
it is so counterintuitive. It is so counterintuitive.
When do women think about men in general, right? Like the average, this is really a bad thing to say actually, but I'm not thinking of another way to say it. The average person, the average female out there. What does the average female think about a man who is showing their vulnerability? Because I've heard a lot of like if you start to get into the whole scene of like red pill, blue pill guys, mm-hmm. right? And guys that are taking back their masculinity, they have this argument that consciously women say that they want their man to be vulnerable, but genetically, biologically, that's not true. And it actually gets us in trouble. And I know you've studied this, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, especially, I mean, our specialty is working with highly ambitious women.
Yes.
And their amazing partners, okay? And so I would venture to say almost all powerful, ambitious women like to be dominated in the bedroom. They don't want to have to be in control in
really?
The bedroom. Yes. They want to be in surrender. They want to be taken. They want to be thrown down. And this could, you know, start a big wave of reaction here. But I've just worked with so many powerful women.
Yeah, you're just
women
saying
over
in your experience,
in my
you've
experience
seen this.
Of, yes.
It's not everybody.
This
we can't
is not
say
every
everybody because
woman.
We don't know everybody. But in
but
your
I'm
experience.
I'm talking about the real change makers in the world. You know, in the behind the scenes, and I've worked with so many people over the years, that the behind the scenes in the bedroom, it's like, can't he just take me? And it's like, yes, and. You can't just be this powerful, ambitious, amazing woman out in the world, in your business, and then completely be the exact opposite in the bedroom. There's a pathway. There is way more available in the bedroom than just full surrender into your partner. And part of it is that sex is messy. Being sexual together is messy. And so to enjoy the mess and the playground that's available of like, oh, whoops, that didn't feel like, oh, you know, and it's squishy and messy. And it's like the women who really want to grow together over a lifetime with a partner need to want to develop the skill set of communication about what they really want and to be able to hear what their partners really want. And we like to teach people how to practice outside of the bedroom with easy topics that they can, you know, agree upon. Things like the towel over the door and things like, you know, how to load the dishwasher, which is usually not that easy for couples. That's kind of a challenging topic. But to have open communication about the things that annoy you with your partner outside of the bedroom so that when you have this activation that happens in the bedroom, that you already have experience together getting through challenging topics and coming through it together. It's kind of like going through an obstacle course together, holding hands, helping each other get through the tires and climbing up the ropes and going through the whole obstacle course together of the challenges that arise and then turning back around together and go, wow, look at what we did together. Like, that was amazing. And it's not always about an orgasm, you know? Sometimes it's about learning what feels good to you in this particular moment.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's kind of like when a man learns what feels good to his partner. And let's just for a moment talk about heterosexual relationships. So if he learns, oh, these three spots, if I rub in this way, if I do this, if I touch here, that's like the magic combo. If he only does that, every day for the rest of his life or every time that you have sex, it will get stale and it won't work. It's kind of like, you know,
dull, boring.
Yes. It's the
loses
same.
The excitement.
Yes. So, you know, I mean, we went through this a few months ago, actually, where I was getting a little lazy in the bedroom. You know, I was just like, I'm just going to lay here, you know? And, you know, it really, I realized it. Julian realized it. And he said something when we were just having a lovely conversation in the bathroom. We have a great bathroom where we have a lot of great conversations. And he mentioned it. And I said, yeah. You know, you're right. I've gotten a little lazy. That's not how I want to show up. But we have that agreement of growth over comfort, which means he's allowed to bring anything to me and I receive it.
And then one of the things that we teach our couples, it's always the two of you against the issue, against the problem, against the challenge. It's never that either one of you is the issue or is the challenge.
Oh, I like that.
Even if One of you is the
catalyst for creating the problem or bringing the problem to the union. But it's always us against the issue, against the problem.
So like
together.
And what's the problem in sex, right? The problem is everyone just wants to feel good, right? I mean, it's a time to connect physically so that you can relax together and have fun together and be playful together and have pleasure.
Exchange energies, because it's really sex is about creating a life at the core. And so there's an exchange of energies and really getting to feel your partner in so
many in union.
Different levels.
And you can do that from a place of honoring God. You can do that from a place of getting down and dirty. You can do that from any location. But if one partner has in their mind, ooh, this is going to be a down and dirty session, and the other partner is like, this is going to be an elevated, sensual God experience, like, you're not on the same page because you haven't talked about it.
Yeah.
You know? And using your words to just get clear before you just jump in is really helpful.
Gotcha. Makes a lot of sense. So really quick, before we wrap this up, if people want to get a hold of you, if they want to learn more, they want to work with you, where do they go? How do we find out more?
Yeah, well, we've got at Instagram, The Intimacy Experts is our handle.
The Intimacy Experts.
The Intimacy Experts.
And then the website is theintimacyexperts.org.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. That's really
great.
We've
got lots of free content and we just give it all away. We love it. So people would like to work with us privately. That's a whole separate conversation. But
and you also speak too, right?
Oh, like, yeah.
Yeah, people want organizations to speak. You come speak for you?
Yeah.
Speak for them, I'm sorry.
Corporates and love. Anything that we can get the word out on. Sex, money, power, ambition.
Communication.
Communication, intimacy.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. Cool. Thank you for being on the show.
Absolutely. This is so much fun. Thank you,
It
David.
Was great. Thank you.
Love it.
Thanks for listening to the Successful Mind Podcast. And if you like what you heard and you want to know more, go to davidnagel.com/freestuff.